Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. We are online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Instagram, and you can see this on our YouTube channel. Thank you. I'm Amanda Haas, Culinary Director of Williams-Sonoma, and your moderator for today's program. This program is part of our Food Lit series underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. So a little bit about our wonderful guest. Jeremiah Tower is the legendary chef and bon vivant who has been called the king of California cuisine. He received a degree in architecture. Wow. I love this. He received a degree in architecture from Harvard, but in the 1970s, his career path took a surprising turn when he became head chef at Chez Panisse in Berkeley. In 1984, Tower opened his own restaurant, Stars, in San Francisco. It was an overnight sensation and fostered the careers of numerous American chefs, including Mark Franz, Mario Batali, Tim Grable, Emily Lucchetti, and Jerry Tronfeld. Stars was among the top...
And Larry Doyle and Sean Lynn.
I love it! Yay! It was one of the top grossing restaurants in the United States for over a decade, I believe. Unbelievable. Did you know that?
It was from 84 to 98.
Wow. Yeah. Wow, that's a long time.
Yeah.
It served as a hub for celebrities and San Francisco elite. Tower went on to win a James Beard Award as the best chef in America, hosted a PBS series, and opened restaurants in Singapore and Hong Kong. After spending most of the last decade in Mexico, we are so thrilled that Jeremiah Tower is back in San Francisco to talk about his latest book called Table Manners, How to Behave in the Modern World and Why Bother. Hi, Chef.
Hi, how are you? Great to be here.
So fun.
Especially with you.
Oh, thank you. And I'm lucky enough, I told you when I met you, to have been a person who was lucky enough to eat at Stars before I ever moved to San Francisco. And I understood how special it was at the time and really what San Francisco dining was really all about. So thank you for having me here tonight to do this
with
you.
My pleasure.
And we thought it would be fun to kind of make it a three-part conversation tonight. I, of course, have a lot of questions about the book and your career. And then we thought we'd do a little lightning round of fun questions for him to shake it up a little bit. And then I would love it if you write questions and we'll pass them down and we'll close the evening with questions from all of you in the audience. Does that sound good? Okay,
sounds
fantastic.
Good.
So obviously you've had this incredible career in food and have met amazing people along the way and have been in many entertaining situations.
Right.
But I was curious, after all this time, what compelled you to write this book about manners and etiquette now?
Well, I mean, the vice president of Macmillan Publishing said to me one day, you know, Jeremiah, I would like you to write this book about manners. And I said, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. You know? Who the hell cares about manners anymore?
Right.
And he said, that's the point.
Mm-hmm.
And then I asked around, you know, various people that I knew in New York and around the United States, and they said, what a wonderful idea. And I thought, it is? Really? I mean, so then I thought, okay, well, if everyone thinks it's a great idea, I'll do it. So I took a sabbatical in Hudson Valley for 6 months and wrote the book, looking at the deer wandering by the pasture, and I just sat there with my computer and wrote the book. And I said to him, you know, I know how to write a cookbook.
Right.
Everybody knows appetizers, eggs, cheese, pasta, fish, you know. And I said, but I have no idea how to write a book on manners. He said, just write, and then I'll tell you.
That's amazing. And what's interesting is that before I read it, I didn't realize how much experience you have with it, because he's experiencing things in restaurant settings and you've always entertained so much. And so to have the context of your career in this book was really helpful to me. And what was interesting too is I felt like so much of the advice was probably obvious, but I needed someone to tell me, to be like, oh wait, we're on the right track here.
Just a tune-up in your case.
A tune-up. And so, you know, that leads to also, I love in the title that you say, how to behave in the modern world and why bother. And I think I was asking myself that question too. And as a parent, I know why I bother. But I love the dedication, he says, to all those parents who care and anyone else who wants to know and anyone's offspring who want to know. And so I think my next question to you is, why should we bother? You know, when so many people seem to kind of be forgetting about basic etiquette.
Because manners give you the tools to get the life you want, the result of your life you want. I was a couple of days ago in Washington, and this very chic, obviously very rich grandmother, Ivy League kind of grandmother, came up to me and said, you know, I think I get the point of this book. My son invited a couple of his friends over for dinner the other day, and this boy, obviously, you know, college-educated
right.
young man, sat down, and he picked up the pork chop in his hands and started gnawing on it, you know. And she said, well, wouldn't you like a knife and fork?
Yeah.
And he said, oh, we don't use knives and forks at my house. And that's the point. At your house, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
But if you want to be invited back, if you want to get your job, if you want your grandmother not to hit you on the knuckles with a ruler, use a knife and fork, you know. So the point is, you have to have been taught how to use a knife and fork, yeah. even if you don't care to ever do it again.
Right.
When you're in the situation, when you've been invited to lunch by the boss whose company you want to work in,
right.
you better know, because it's a tool
right.
to get what you want.
It's such a great point, and as a parent now, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, he's so right. I just think when my kids go out into the world, please remember to use your utensils. What are they
right.
doing? But
right.
it's so true. You teach them, and how you wrapped up the book was interesting in that you say manners and etiquette, really, it's for other people to have nice manners, too, and to know how to behave in certain social situations like that.
Right.
Which is true, right? So one subject that I think is so interesting with etiquette that we're all experiencing is with the advent of social media. It's completely changed the table. And I love the chapter. What do you call it?
Techiquette.
Right. And you had some really great advice that, of course, we should all probably know. But again, I needed to read it. Will you share with people your thoughts about Instagramming at the table, taking photos right. of your food, Facebook? We'll just go through all of them.
The main point of the book is, and when I wrote the book, I didn't want any of my grandmother going, you know. It was, I said, whenever I said, you know, don't do something, I didn't say don't. I just explained the situation and said for the following reasons. And the whole, as you say, technology and cell phone thing, the point of the book, as I say in the beginning and the very end, it's not about you.
Right.
No situation is about you, unless there's an ambulance parked by you and, you know, they need to pick you up. Then it's really about you. But apart from that, it's never about you. It's about the other people. So when you're at a dinner party, mm-hmm. you know, if the host, if you're in a restaurant and somebody else is hosting the dinner party, and they're all taking photographs and putting it on Instagram, fine.
Right.
But if somebody else is giving a dinner party and you start doing that, they would be horrified that that privacy is being shared without their permission. Mm-hmm. So I just say, oh, whatever you do, wait 2 seconds and look around to see what everyone else is doing, what the host or hostess is doing. If they're all taking selfies and shots of the food and everything, fine. But, you know, the other day I saw, a couple of months ago, somebody with a selfie like that, their hand went up, and the waiter going by with a platter of lobsters, and the lobsters went
Boom.
Flying. Of course, I wanted to follow the lobsters.
Excuse me. Gotta go.
Yeah, free lobsters. But, you know, I mean, imagine that's a disaster, you know.
Yeah.
So it's really about the other people at the table, it's the host and hostess. Whatever they're doing, look around, see what they're doing, and take the cue from that. Because mm-hmm. it's never about you.
It's such great advice, and I think the thing that's interesting is we tend to blame all of these bad manners on technology now, but your point about really when you're getting on your phone, you could be doing something else. It's just that you're no longer paying attention to the people at the table, right? So if you'd rather be somewhere else, go somewhere else, which I thought was so good, but it's become so common for us to think that we have to pick up that phone or take that picture of the food, but it's just more of a social signal that we'd Right. rather be doing something besides enjoying the company that we're with.
I mean, just slap them in the face. It's faster.
Right. Or leave.
Like, or leave, you know.
You got to go.
Oh, this is boring. I'm out of here.
I'd rather
do
something.
No, that's the message. That's the message.
Right. It is the message. And the other thing I loved, you said, you know what? Once you pull out your phone, others will too. Have you ever been in that situation where you're having a lovely time and no one is using their phone and the first one goes up and then the meal is lost?
There are some situations, you know, when you go into a big party or a meeting or a dinner party or somebody's mm-hmm. house, mm-hmm. if the babysitter's having a fit,
right?
If, you know, the deal to sell your house or to buy a house is coming through at any minute, explain.
Right.
That's fine. I mean, in that case, I would keep my cell phone on, and I'd have one hand on it, you know.
Yeah.
But I would say to the host or the whoever is giving the party or mm-hmm. the event, I may need to answer my phone because something really important is coming up. But then, you know, if it vibrates, get up, go to the side of the room, and answer the phone. Because, you know, so many in the restaurant business, in restaurants now in America, there's so much competition. You know, I don't like garlic. I can't eat lobsters, you know. And, hey, wait a minute. This is not a competition, you know. This is just a dinner party. You're trying to have fun.
We can get to that as well. I love how you handle people's requests for not being able to tolerate foods. I do feel like there's such a heightened amount of that now where we feel like it's more socially acceptable to say, I can't have this, that, and that. And if you're, you know, if someone's throwing a party, it's really great manners to just roll with it unless there's exactly. something that really you cannot have.
Right.
Yeah, so it's just a change in kind of how things are going today around food. So I love it. I think that I can't wait to read this chapter at home and all come to an agreement. And even with my friends. I don't know if at parties you're doing the same thing. Everybody picks up those phones and you go crazy.
Liam last night.
Yeah, he's wonderful.
He said he has a bowl. He gives a dinner party, he has a bowl. And when the people come in, he said, please put your cell phone in the bowl.
I love it. I love it. Case closed.
Case closed.
Yeah. Somebody wants to find you, they'll find you.
Right.
They'll really find you.
Right.
So it's good. One of the other important themes in the book, if you haven't had the chance to read it, which I loved, is that as a chef, people would probably assume otherwise, but you say food's not the most important part of the party. And that it's really about coming together with people and beautiful decor and just being together. That might sound surprising to a lot of people since you've cooked incredible food for everybody. But what do you think it is that makes a party really special?
Conversation, which is why I wrote that chapter.
Right.
Because I say, you know, if everyone has manners, the right manners and conversation, then it's going to be a successful evening.
Right.
If it's just fabulous food and nobody's talking, I mean, you might as well be watching Game
World
of Thrones.
Series.
Or tonight, the World Series. Yeah. I'm sure a lot of you wishing you were, you know.
But I find it interesting because I think a lot of people, when they find out that you cook for a living, they assume they have to do something really fancy to invite you into their home. And I always joke that I'm just excited to be invited over to someone's home come around a table together.
Exactly.
So, but if you were throwing a party and you were cooking, what are your favorite things to cook when you're entertaining?
I think it's important to not make everybody nervous. And if you're nervous because of how you're cooking or the timing or something, everyone's going to be nervous.
Right.
So the first course, definitely cold and, you know, plated and covered with saran or something. So, you've got that together.
Right.
Then, in my case, because, you know, I'm known as a cook, I have to cook something in front of everyone. You know. So I just, finish something off. If I wasn't so embarrassed, I'd flame something, but, you know. And then the dessert is already done. And a lot depends on whether it's you're serving in a dining room or it's, next to the kitchen or part of the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And you can just cook the food there and put it up on the kitchen center island. People can help themselves. It depends on what kind of seating and everything.
Right.
Definitely make it as easy and as planned on yourself as possible, because then everyone can relax.
I feel like people relax when they know that the host is relaxed.
Absolutely.
Right? So if you've made your food and there's only one thing you're putting together, you can really enjoy your company and have a wonderful conversation. Do you entertain at all now? Do you like to entertain still?
No, I hate to entertain because I don't have my restaurant staff, you know, to make me look good.
Do all the dishes, the meats. Yeah.
I'm only famous because of the team that I had, it's difficult to look really good when you're doing it all yourself. Yeah,
it's true. Timing.
No place
different.
To hide.
Like I'll be in back. There's no back. So funny. I also love a lot of the basic etiquette that you get to when throwing a party in terms of even walking into a room and knowing how to introduce yourself. So there's a lot around hello and goodbye that I thought was interesting in your book. Please share a little bit of your story about even how to go get someone a drink or start a conversation when you walk into a party.
I think it's very important that you give your full name, first of all. I mean, if it's a big party or even 12 people dinner party or something. If I'm the host, I'm probably, right down to the wire with the preparations and things. So I love it if somebody comes in and says their whole name. You may have not met them before.
Right.
But they know who you are because you've invited them.
Exactly.
But, you know, hi, Jocelyn. You know. So I think you just, again, you're not thinking about yourself.
Yep.
You're thinking, what can I do to make the host or hostess the most relaxed? Mm-hmm. Which includes all those, you know, things you're supposed to bring to the house and everything.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, too.
Yeah. So you're not thinking about yourself. You're thinking about what is it that would make them feel the best and most comfortable.
Right. Even he talks about the fact, you know, if you go and you notice there's a bar, if you've just met a stranger saying, hey, can I go get you a drink, right? Those common things that you do and you come back and you introduce yourself to the next new person who you haven't met before.
Absolutely. So
I loved all of it because they were great reminders on how to just kind of behave when you're around new people.
And also that, you know, offering to help.
Oh, I loved this.
Can I help you? Get out of my face, you know, I mean, do I have to stop and think what, you know, you can do to help me? I mean, I say, you know, you see the bottles of wine there and there's an opener. I mean, are those corks going to jump out of the bottles by themselves? Is there a mystery to what's supposed to happen to those bottles? No, open the wine, you know.
It's so funny, but it's true. You're like, give them a specific task, because I think sometimes when people say, can I help, it's insincere.
What they mean is they don't want to help.
I don't want to get up from the table, so I love it. Yes.
I mean, it's very good manners to offer to help, but it's manners to offer to help. It's good manners to actually do it.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
And, you know, washing up or something, or, you know, jumping in and everyone's dumping all the dishes into the sink, and you really don't want them in the sink. You want them on the counter, so...
Right.
It's perfectly fine to say, no, thank you very much. When I come to your house, I'm not going to lift a finger.
Honesty.
Right.
It works, too. I'd rather have that, right? So you mentioned the hostess gifts, but I think typically it's so common to bring a bottle of wine to someone's house, especially, or flowers. So can you share with people your thoughts on those things and what you prefer to bring?
You know, that act of giving, that can be very aggressive. Coming with a huge, I mean, if you're being really generous and nice, you bring this huge thing of flowers, you know, stemmed flowers, not in a vase or anything.
Right.
And, you know, what is the host or hostess going to do?
Stop everything.
Stop everything when the time, their timing, very privately, but they know what they're doing. The timing is what it is. And now they have to stop for 30 minutes and put, you know, cut the bottoms, put them in a beautiful vase and figure out where they're going to go. No, no, that's an imposition. Send them the day before.
So lovely.
Or the day after, you know?
Right.
And the wine, you bring one bottle. Now, the good host has already figured out. I mean, okay, you're a student or it's potluck or something. That's different. But if it's a fairly organized, formal dinner party and you bring a bottle of wine, and I think, what am I going to do with this now? You know, where do I fit that in?
Right.
And if you don't pour it, they think you're being greedy and hoarding it for yourself. And if you do pour it, it's one bottle for six people, which is...
feels awkward.
Awkward. So I think the best gifts are the day before or day after.
I love it. Same with RSVPs. Or RSVPs and then thank you notes I love too.
Right,
24
absolutely.
24 hours, right?
24 hours.
You just do it.
A text, wonderful party, thank you.
That's love it. That.
You know, as you're getting in your car to leave. And then the next day an email or especially a note in the next 24 hours.
What are the biggest faux pas you've seen at parties? Are there any that stand out to you of don't ever do that?
Oh, my God. Probably I've done them all.
I know, right? Makes you an expert in some way. Don't take it.
The biggest faux pas is to basically try and dominate the situation. You know, when you're talking, the conversation starts at the table, and you're talking, and then somebody else brings up another subject, and you wait there, and you keep trying to reintroduce your subject. As I say, you know, if they have, in 5 seconds after that person has brought up another point, if nobody's asking you to continue, then forget it. It's dead.
Move on.
Move on.
It's true. It can really change the tone of a situation.
Right, and then this person, you know, pushing and pushing and pushing into the conversation. Right. And finally, everybody's like, what the hell's going on here?
Yeah. This kind of brings up another topic. I can see my friend Merritt out there today who I was with, and she brought it up You speak about this with an election a week away. How do you discuss politics, or what do you know when to discuss politics or religion at a dinner table?
I have to read that bit.
Do you, you want to? I think the rules have probably changed since you even wrote the book.
No. Because
it's really interesting.
There are sex, religion, and politics you're not supposed to talk about.
But you'll make
some
exceptions.
But I call it's the volatile triumvirate. Because I think you should talk about it. But anyway, here we go. When the conversation sags, there are always these three topics. Long considered taboo, they often make for the most interesting conversations. But dive in at your own risk. Politics. It can be fascinating to discuss affairs of state if you are sure that everyone has the manners to stay calm. If you're at ease with your beliefs, let others be with theirs. And unless you are certain you are surrounded by others who like heated conversations, abort if things turn nasty. It's a dinner, not a debate.
Yeah.
Time to learn, not to lecture. Religion. As with politics, if you are content in a religious skin, let others be in theirs. Mm-hmm. Sex. Sex is an acceptable subject when it's about other people. Kind, funny, and spoken with an air of astonishment.
Now I'm picturing you. Thank you. I'm picturing you in the Hudson Valley just riding away all of these hysterical things. But I love that you get this
A bottle of champagne and I'm laughing to myself.
I feel like we get a piece of your personality in this book, too, and that you're not taking any of it too seriously.
No, because I had a grandmother. I mean, this is a grandmother who used to wash eggs in soap and water before boiling them.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, when I was 24, just the two of us, my grandfather died, were sitting in Carmel out on the terrace in the summer, boiling hot. I was wearing a coat and tie. And she said, have you washed your hands? I was 25 years old. And I thought, that's never going to appear in this book.
Right. That's so funny. It's unbelievable. Well, the holidays are coming upon us, too, and I love how you talk about what happens when people might be a little overserved at a party or get out of control. How do you handle guests who've had a little too much fun at your party?
Put them to bed. Find somebody in the party who's okay, not in that state, and find a good friend who's not in that state and say, would you take this person home? Would you help me out in this situation? Because even if you just, take them down and find a taxi or something, you're not quite sure what's going to happen.
Right.
So I think it's very fine to take your best friend at the party and impose on them and say, see this person home.
See them home. You say it's everyone's everyone's responsibility at the party when that happens.
Exactly.
Everyone has to depend on everyone for great manners at that point.
A great party is a team effort.
Right? It's true.
Yeah.
It's so true. Well, the book also talks a lot about table manners and etiquette in a restaurant, and obviously he is so well known for Stars. Like I said earlier, I just have this incredible memory of sitting at this table and feeling like the place was special and unique. And at the age I was, I think it was probably the finest dining experience I'd ever had in my life. I couldn't pinpoint it, but now I probably could if I went back. But what do you think it is that made that restaurant so special?
Johnny Apple, who was the food correspondent for the New York Times, said that Stars was the most democratic restaurant in America. So it was, everything for someone rather than the other way around.
Uh-huh.
So you could come to the bar and have a hamburger and a glass of Chateau Lafite or Chilean Merlot, if you wanted. Danielle Steele sitting there at table 25, and she'd come in and she had she'd promised to show me these new diamonds. So she came in one night, opening at the opera or something, and she had Kleenex over this finger and Kleenex over that finger.
Oh, my gosh.
And she sat down and the bodyguards appeared, and she was in a, $200,000 Dior dress, so I'd been warned, so there was no red wine near
anywhere.
The table. And she whipped off the Kleenex in Jeremiah, $2 million. And I had seated at the next table was a young, both underaged, two couples who was sort of like a prom night or something.
Yeah.
And I brought them champagne. and, you know, served them myself. And I just thought, you know, that was stars. Mm-hmm. And they were so excited to be sitting next to Daniel Steele. And Daniel Steele was so excited not to have any red wine near her. that was stars. It was, you know, everything for someone.
Right.
So you could come back and have a great dinner. You could sit at the bar and have oysters and champagne. You could sit at the oyster bar. Yeah, it was just a free-flowing experience.
Could you see what you wanted it to be before you opened it? Like, I just think about everything that went into it. Did you have that vision, or did it just kind of evolve as you opened the doors?
Both. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't possibly have conceived what it was actually going to become. But the location I did choose very carefully and was told I was out of my mind. And, of course, it took me 4 years to raise a dollar to do it because no one believed. And I said, look, my vision is, because my vision was the night I walked into Beurs sur l'Étoile in Paris, and there were, right in the table by the entrance, were two models. Absolutely beautiful, rail model, thin, mm-hmm. perfect women. And they had a imperial of seafood, so it was four or five layers,
beautiful.
You know, that thing. And they had long red fingernails, and they were digging into the crab like that and going, with their long tongue sticking out. I thought, whoa, I want a restaurant like that.
Everything about it was right.
So I thought, how do I do that? And I said, okay, we've got all the people from the opera and the symphony. At lunch, we'll have all the politicians selling us down the river. The lawyers, if they lose a case, they'll drink. If they win a case, they'll drink.
Yep.
Lunch is taken care of. And the evening, people will come before the performance, yep. regulars during the performance, and then they'll come back after the performance. So that's what happened.
You knew the location.
And somehow, we cooked for it, right? I don't know how we did, but we did. We got it done.
It's incredible. So much has been written about you and truly changing the landscape of American cooking. I mean, what we call California cuisine, which you are obviously a huge part of. But in both contexts, at Chez Panisse and at Starz, were you aware at the time of how much you were changing the landscape of American cooking, or were you just cooking?
It's a very good question, because I'll answer it one way first. Mm-hmm. When I say to people, what was it like? And I say, well, there were no fresh herbs, no olive oil, no nothing. People, when you say that to someone, their eyes glaze over because, mm-hmm. you know, that's so impossible, right?
Right.
But actually, so much has changed since 1972 or 3 or 4, which is why I did that California regional dinner, to show that, you know, get everybody excited. Mm-hmm. But so to answer the question, no. We were just trying to fill up the restaurant.
Right.
Do whatever we could to get customers in there. We had no idea. I mean, looking, there's so much been written about it mm-hmm. that it seems stupid to say that we didn't know, but absolutely had no idea.
Incredible.
It was just, what do you got to do to fill the restaurant and pay the bills?
But looking back, you can see it now. A little bit revolutionary.
Yeah. I mean, again, you know, I mean, the French would come in and say, wow, this is the most amazing thing. I'd say, well, no, wait a minute. You're the amazing ones. What are we? Mm-hmm. What are you talking mm-hmm. about? And there was Jean Troigros came in and said, you know, I envy you. This was in 1974. And I went, you envy me? Hello? I mean, you're the most famous chef in the world. And he said, I have a 3-star Michelin restaurant.
Handcuffs. Yeah.
And the amazing article a couple of weeks ago about... It came out about Michelin, but that's another story.
That's another story for another visit, hopefully, right? One thing that I'd love to share before maybe we start our speed round is I find it so fascinating that you went to Harvard and studied architecture. And I know that you hear the story that he comes and he's this young man who had not been professionally trained and you just lit the culinary world on fire. How did you learn how to cook, and how did you make that shift and know you were doing the right thing?
Well, how I knew how to cook, that's what I'll answer that in a second. Mm-hmm. I mean, how I did it was because I was desperate and starving.
Yeah.
I had $25 to my name.
Wow.
My roommate at college and his wife in San Francisco said, you know, there's this article, this advertisement in the newspaper, this place called Chez Panisse is looking for a chef. And it said, you know, cooking in the style of Elizabeth David and Fernand Poing. Well, I knew that by heart. I've been reading those books for years.
Wow.
So I thought, well, okay, I've got $25. I have to do whatever the next thing is. So I did it. If I'd known what it was like to be a chef or run a restaurant, I would have run a mile. How I knew how to cook was because my parents traveled all over the world, mm-hmm. And ate in the best restaurants, the best ships,
wow.
all that experience. So I knew the taste.
Right.
I had lived what I call now the benchmarks. In other words, I had tasted the best smoked salmon in the world.
Right.
So I had tasted, you know, what, God help us, duck à l'orange was supposed to be, you know. No marmalade in that dish when I, you know. So I knew what a sauce Madeira sauce was supposed to taste like. Mm-hmm. I knew how to make it, sort of, because in graduate school and college, I'd cooked for my friends. Mm-hmm. I'd worked my way through Julia Child and Escoffier, Ma Cuisine, La Guide Culinaire. You know, I'd done all those things, cooked like crazy. So if you have recipe or something you want to do and you have had the taste of the best one in the world, then you find your way there. That's how it happened.
You must have one of those palates too. I've met cooks who can memorize what they've had and they can repeat it. I mean, it's just a gift that at that age, with no formal training, you can just figure it out. It's pretty unbelievable.
Yeah, I know where that comes from, but you know, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. Lucky. Right. Genetics, maybe. So before we start, I'd love to do the lightning round and have some fun with some less serious questions, but a little reminder that this is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we're talking to Chef Jeremiah Tower about his new book, Table Manners, How to Behave in the Modern World and Why Bother. I'm Amanda Haas, Culinary Director of Williams-Sonoma, and your moderator, if you hadn't figured that out yet. You can listen to Commonwealth Club programs on the radio or podcast, watch on the YouTube channel, check out the website, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. So now for the next section, to shake it up a little bit, I'm so curious because I've only read about you and had never met you, so I thought it'd be really fun if we just asked you some really quick-fire questions.
Absolutely.
Just your preferences about food and other things. So when I ask you, will you just give me your first response?
Rapid
fire. And I'll go easy on you to start. We're going to warm up to some tougher ones, okay? What's your favorite?
Go for it.
Vegetable.
Favorite vegetable?
Yeah.
Potato.
Does that count still? It counts.
Well, when it's with truffles and duck fat, yes.
Butter or olive oil?
Together.
Nice. Agreed. Favorite spice?
Cardamom.
Red or white wine?
Le Monrocher from the Domaine de Romani Conti.
I love it. I love it.
I've only had it twice in my life, but I can't wait for the next time.
It's funny you can remember it, too.
Right.
Would you rather be a guest at a party or a host of the party?
Guest. Done too many hosts.
Yeah, right. San Francisco, Coit Tower or Transamerica Building?
They're both ugly.
So what would you pick? What's your favorite landmark here?
Oh, my newest favorite restaurant.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. Well, we had lunch at Zuni today. Zuni. Oh. There's my landmark.
Zuni. There's a landmark. That's a wonderful landmark.
Right.
Yeah, that's great. What's your favorite dish for Thanksgiving?
Definitely not turkey. A caviar blini.
I love it. Still caviar champagne all the
Absolutely.
Way, right?
Absolutely.
That's fantastic.
Or smoked salmon, yeah.
Okay, with your time in Mexico, I love Mexico and haven't spent much time yet, but had a chance to go to Mexico City last year, dig in a little bit. Flour or corn tortillas?
Corn.
Corn, always?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you eat street food? And if so, what's your favorite street food?
Only. Every 4 or 5 mornings a week at 10 o'clock, I go to the Santiago market or the main market of the Mercado and have lechon or cochinita tacos. But my favorite on Thursday morning are the pig's feet tacos.
What a wonderful life. Sounds fantastic.
And the venison tacos are not bad either.
Oh my gosh, incredible. Okay, tequila or bourbon?
Tequila.
Tequila all the way.
I too much bourbon in college. I can't look at it now.
That'll do it. It'll do it to you. Sweet or salty?
Salty.
Salty. And another one. What's your favorite country to visit for food?
Italy.
Oh, I agree. I definitely agree. It's a good one. What else? Any others?
Outside of Asia.
Italy. Outside of Asia.
Other would be Penang.
Okay. Favorite condiment you could put on anything?
Lime pickle from India.
Oh my God, I love that you know right away. He's got his opinions. It's so good. Okay, what do you say we ask? I ask you some of the questions from the audience.
There we go.
So let's see. At a party, introductions made silence. Can't think of a single thing to say. Nada. And it feels like you're forever silent. Help. So if no one has any conversation starters, I think, what do you do?
Sex, religion, or politics. Yeah.
Fire up the party.
Right. Be ready to run, but go for it.
In that order? That'll keep people busy for a little while.
Well, maybe,
right?
Maybe in the reverse order.
Religion, politics. Like, how many people would
these
be
days,
left?
Politics must be last, you know, get everybody.
It's so true. My gosh. What is the most memorable dinner conversation that you can recall? And please tell us a short story about it.
Count Sheremetyev, when I was 16, with my Russian aunt and uncle, with a crown prince of Poland, of which there are many, I think. And he told a story about what was the most decadent thing in life, and he told a story that Yusupov, who was the guy who killed Rasputin, said chateau de Kim and roast beef. But the so-called crown prince of Poland said, when one of the guests asked my aunt for an aspirin, she said, I think I need to take an aspirin. He said, take the France instead, it leaves at 6. I thought that was the wittiest thing I'd ever heard. I was 16. SS France, of course, being the most beautiful luxury liner in the world at the time. And I just thought, one day I will live to say that remark.
Have you yet?
No, because the France was, you know, they shipped, I mean, they put it in dry dock.
I love it. That's pretty funny.
Take the France instead, it leaves at 6. Oh, my God.
Incredible. I love that you remember it. This is an interesting question. Some of San Francisco's best bartenders also worked at Stars. Do you have any comments about the change in cocktail culture and or any bar-specific etiquette advice?
Yes, I mean, my God. I mean, I did the Tavern on the Green for 3 months. It was an amazing experience. And I said to the bartenders, okay, it's time to, you know, think of some wonderful cocktails. Mm-hmm. And I said, why don't you make, and she said, well, I have a Manhattan. I said, make a classic Manhattan. She said, oh, no, that's boring. I'll make mine. I said, please don't. There was a Japanese restaurant here on Union Square. A couple of years ago, I was in there, and I said, you know, I'd like a Manhattan up. And he said, I'll do my Manhattan. I was naive in those 2 years ago, so I said, fine.
Right.
And he was, you know, when you want a cocktail, you want a cocktail. Mm-hmm. You're, that's the moment. You've been working all day. It's 7 o'clock. You're at the bar. You want your cocktail. And he brought it. He started making this cocktail and cocktail and cocktail. And then he brought this dome over, and he pumped it full of smoke. And there was smoke going over the place. I can't repeat what I said.
Can't you? Yeah. You know what's so funny? I was thinking, I'm like, don't tell me they smoked it. But they did.
They did.
Yeah, sometimes I feel like we've
gone... And he was so proud of it. I just thought, oh, God. Oh,
trying to impress you.
Right.
And we've gone too far sometimes. There's something great about just the classics.
Right.
Right, so...
As in food, more than... Well, I'll be generous. I was going to say 3, but let's say more than 5 ingredients on a plate is a mess. Mm-hmm. And a cocktail, the same. When you're a kid, you have a watercolor box, right? And it's got mm-hmm. 8 colors. And you're so fascinated with that. When they bring you a box that has 24 colors, you start mixing them up. Every time you mix anything, it turns to brown.
It's true.
Food, cocktails, the same.
It's true. It's great. But it's probably the secret, like in cocktails in your cooking too, in terms of just knowing... You show restraint in terms of how
restraint.
Many things you're using. And it makes all the difference.
Let the ingredients speak for themselves. And if you have 12 ingredients in a cocktail, I mean, there's no speaking. It's just a mess.
It's going to be brown. And it's going to
be brown.
I love the question and the follow-up, too. Any bar-specific etiquette advice? I don't know if that's when you're entertaining at a bar or spending time with people in a bar. Any advice?
I think when somebody's invited you for dinner at a restaurant and you all gather in the bar... It's a very nice gesture to buy the cocktails yourself, let the host buy the dinner. I think it's a very nice gesture. Also, when you're at the bar in a restaurant, you know, you get your cocktail, move away.
Yeah.
Because, you know, somebody else, there are all these other people, I'm trying to get my drink too, and I don't want to have to sort of push you aside or say, would you please move? Mm-hmm. Excuse me, would you please move? Move.
Move.
Yeah, no, I don't want to do that. So, yeah.
It's great advice, and I think it's better for the entire restaurant, too. The servers right. are trying to access everything.
Right.
And so,
exactly.
But what a lovely gesture if you're arriving at a party in a restaurant to buy everybody a round of drinks and
absolutely.
Move on.
And take
it's
the
classy.
Heat off. Take the heat off the host. Yeah.
Exactly.
Or hostess.
So here's a cute one. When I mention the word etiquette, it usually sparks eye rolls and me mentioning Emily Post, as my granny taught me. How do I get over that and keep it relevant? So how do you keep etiquette relevant? That's interesting.
Don't get over it. You should eye roll at those awful books. It's like my grandmother, you know, have you washed your hands? You know, come on, you know. It's everything has changed, but everything has changed so much. Let's not lose the essence of good manners, which is to be completely aware of the people around you. So if you take that as a rule, then you can figure out, you know, what good manners are.
Mm-hmm.
But those books, when I was writing this book, I, you know, got all those books and read them. I was bored out of my mind.
It's
I mean,
true.
I shouldn't say things about other authors, but they are boring and they don't fit.
Right.
You know, I mean, if you're in Connecticut and you want to give a, you know, an August wedding and you've got enough money and you read that chapter in one of those books about how to give a wedding, perfect advice.
Right.
Because that's what everyone expects.
Yes.
But other than that, no.
Forget about it.
Yeah.
I love it. I mean, even you finally give everybody permission with elbows on the table. I look around all the time. I'm like, is this okay? And you say in the book, it happens
yeah.
now.
Yeah. I mean, God, I'd be so uncomfortable if I couldn't put my elbows on the table. But if it was somebody who's giving the dinner and that would make them furious if you did, then don't.
Don't do it. Right.
And there's a moment, you know, you don't do it right away. But as, you know, people start to relax and the main course is gone, yeah,
you know,
go for it.
Take the lead of the host.
Yeah.
Two-part question. What was left out of the book? And then how do you correct someone who holds their fork vertically when they cut their steak? I'm picturing it. Can't you see it?
You don't invite them back.
Only if they're 10.
I see that. Yeah. If it's a child, you tell the parents that they, you know, they've done something terribly wrong. you sort of give, you know, a significant look to the child and But oh boy. Some situations are just so vulgar. You just have to hide.
There's nothing you can
There's
do about it.
Nothing you can do, yeah.
And did you leave anything out of the book? Were there any chapters you really wanted to write?
Yes, the international. So I want to write the next book, which is how to behave in around the world and the difference. I mean, it's not just because the English eat asparagus like that and you don't do that here
yeah.
or you eat chicken with your fingers here and you don't in England. I mean, those are perfectly obvious. But I told the introduction to the next book will be when I was in Morocco, in Tangier,
right.
I walked into a restaurant and I sat down and, you know, started to look at the menu and order, and the waiter and a few people around me were like that. And I thought, oh dear, you know.
What have I done?
And then I looked up and saw the next people who came in, and they went to the basin in the middle of the dining room and washed their hands. So I immediately, and this is the same in Merida, all the beach restaurants have the same thing.
Oh, really?
So I was a hero in Merida because I already knew how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I went up and washed my hands, and everyone, right, he's not a barbarian.
But you took the lead, and you start
by
to
watching.
Introduce this in this book, right. The international
right.
piece of things, and that you just look at the person you respect the most in the room, and you hope that you get it right by
right.
following their lead.
Right. Exactly.
It's true. Let's see what else. Okay, so that was left out of the book, but that's exciting because that sounds like the next book you want to write.
That's the next book, yeah.
No more cookbooks?
Oh, maybe, yeah.
Maybe.
But at the moment, I'm concentrating on the next volume of this.
Okay, fantastic. That'll be a great one. Maybe we should do this in Paris or other places in the world, right?
Well, then I get to travel and try it out.
Exactly. Oh, I love this. Do you have any plans to open a restaurant ever again? Pretty please.
On a plane coming here, I just saw Bourne Identity. Uh-huh. At the end, he visits, sees his girlfriend again. He walks into her restaurant, which is right on the water, and it's all white and it's simple. Mm-hmm. It's just a bar and a few tables, and it's right on the water. And I thought, yes, I'm doing that. You know, I looked it up on the internet, and it's actually a restaurant that exists in Mykonos. Not that I would do a restaurant in Mykonos, but it was perfect. Yes, I would do that.
You would. Yes, but you're not dreaming of it. You're not waking up every day thinking,
I'm talking to someone in 2 weeks about it.
Oh, yeah. That's thrilling. Yeah. It's fantastic. Here? What beach?
Too cold here.
Yeah, you need a little more sunshine, a little less fog, right?
Right.
So do you miss that restaurant world? Is there part of you that wakes up every day and misses that rush of having to be...
Yes, especially when I'm in restaurants and I see, well, you know, God, I could do that much better. You know, if I had my team, yeah. I could do that better. Yeah,
right. It must be hard. It must be so strange to walk away from that and then go in and feel that energy again. There's nothing quite like it.
It's the adrenaline feeling when stars right. on a Saturday night when it was working.
My gosh.
Friday nights are tricky because everybody's so eager to have a good time, you know, and they're all misbehaved. Mm-hmm. But they've already done that. So Saturday night, you know, was usually the people on time and it was, you know, calmer, bigger numbers and everything. But, you know, when it's working well, mm-hmm. that adrenaline rush must be like, you know, going out onto a stage, you know, if an opera star and you get 15 standing ovations or something.
Right.
Yeah, it must
a
be
rush.
Like that. Because the rush is unbelievable.
Yeah. Incredible.
Yeah.
I like this one, too. Can you give your favorite story? Is it about the Peak Cafe in Hong Kong? I was a fan and a regular.
Oh, who is that?
Yeah. So great.
Peak Cafe, my favorite restaurant that I ever did. I adored that restaurant.
Really?
Also, it made a huge amount of money. you know, I mean, it sort of coincided, you know, when I was 3 years old or something, coincided with the Civic Center being closed down and stars starting to be really challenged. So I just wrote a check for $500,000 out of the Peak Cafe and shoved it into Star San Francisco. And that kept things going for, you know, a week or something. My favorite story about the Peak Cafe, I mean, it was the governor of Hong Kong's idea that I do it.
Wow.
And I got a call here at Stars one day saying, you know, you've got the lease, the contract from the government. I thought, oh, how wonderful. Oh, my God, you know. One day, it was 2 months old or something, and you heard these legendary stories in Hong Kong that if you piss off the staff in a restaurant, they just walk out.
Wow.
You know, middle of lunch, put everything down and walk. They're gone, down the street. So one day, the head cook came to me and said, the chef and the maitre d' and a few people, the managers, and said, Jeremiah, we need to talk to you after lunch. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, you know, I have my return ticket to San Francisco? So after lunch, I went out, and they were all seated there eating these 2 kilos of rice apiece. And I said, okay. And they said, we need to talk to you about overtime. We will work 11 hours a day, 6 days a week, but after that, we want time and a half. And I said, absolutely not. Thinking, you know, so I rushed to the kitchen, called the chef of the Mandarin Hotel, and said, this is what happened, what do I do? He said, go back, very reluctantly agree to everything they demand, which I did.
The secret to your success there.
66 hours a week and then time and a half. Yeah.
Isn't that unbelievable? Wow, that's crazy. Wow. Okay, I have to say before we go there, I was diagnosed gluten intolerant about 5 years ago. I was getting really sick, so I'm leading you because you can say whatever you want about me. But I love this. All it says is gluten-free allergies. Please discuss. Where do we start? And we kind of started with, you know, people coming to your party or to your restaurant and having a list of demands of things they can't have.
Well, it's gotten really out of hand because now it's become a competition to show you how knowledgeable you are by being so demanding.
Mm-hmm.
And going around the table, blah, blah, I mean, that's you know, just everybody at the table, please shut up. But, so gluten-free, I must say, a few years ago I thought, oh, is this just another
fad,
you know?
It fixation. Sounds like a diet.
But when you think about it, Because, you know, 40 years ago, I began to wonder, why do Americans have so much cancer?
Right.
And that's when I said, you know, it's not fast food, it's fast death. Mm-hmm. So thinking, remembering that, I thought, they have screwed around with our food so much that who knows what that wheat is.
You know?
So I thought at first, oh, please be quiet.
Right.
I don't need to hear that. But now I think there's something really going on. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are lots of people saying, oh, I'm gluten-free because, you know, their neighbor said it or something.
Yeah, or they want to lose 5 pounds.
Or they want to lose 5 pounds, yeah. But I'm sure there's something to it. Mm-hmm. Because they have violated the ingredients so much. You know, when you say you're a vegan or a vegetarian or you don't do this or that, but what can you possibly eat that isn't? There is nothing, nothing that is pure anymore. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you just do your best. You find your way through it. Mm-hmm. You don't eat commercial, industrialized, processed food. Stay away from that. And, you know, farmer's market and everything, I mean, you don't know, you don't really know what they're doing. Organic doesn't really mean anything anymore, but it can. If it's the person you trust is saying organic, then it probably is. But if it's, you know, oh boy, I was about to say that. I'm not going to say that. Did I say Chipotle? No, I didn't. No, no. If Steve Ells was, you know, started his career at Stars. So
oh, I didn't know
if
that.
It's, you know, if it's McDonald's, putting a big picture of a cow in, you know, in the restaurant and saying, you know, we're pure and local. I mean, please.
Yeah, right.
So, but behind the lines, they have screwed up our food supply very badly.
Right. So that being said, whose responsibility is it if you're hosting a party or someone's coming to your home for a party to, do you always ask if you're the host or if there are any food intolerances or do you try to accommodate that? Or do you just cook what you want to cook and people can figure it out when they get to your home?
The list now, because it's so much fad mm-hmm. is involved in this, is so long. I can't mm-hmm. possibly ask everybody, you know, because I'm going to get so many demands that now I don't want to do the party.
Yeah.
But the obvious ones, because I, you know, I'm not going to, do I have epinephrine?
Yeah, the EpiPen.
EpiPens. You know, I should. If you give a dinner party these days, you should probably have 5 EpiPens. And that's not a joke. I mean, I'm fortunate. I never had, you know, food allergies.
Right.
But I have seen, at Stars, I have seen, you know, nut and shellfish allergy. I'm just going to drop dead.
Right.
At the table, you know. So.
In restaurants, what do you do? Does it drive you crazy if people request or they come to your restaurant, they say, I can't have this, I can't have that?
You put it on the description. If there's, you know, nuts and shellfish, those are the two big ones. You make very clear in the description of the dish that it's there, you know, because I can't rely on the waiter to remember to say it. So you put it in the description so people reading, do I want this dish, they read that. Mm-hmm. But it's their responsibility. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really, it's from a restaurateur's point of view, people who are taking no responsibility for these deathly moments, leave it all up to you? No, excuse me. You know, I mean, if you don't tell me and you die, that's your problem. excuse me. I'm not a soothsayer.
Yeah.
But the waiters were all trained on everything that went into a dish. And then we cooked every dish every night. And they all tasted that dish, you know. So, and then given the description, what they were supposed to say to the public. And then if there was any of those really dangerous things, we said, don't forget.
Right.
But it was also on the menu.
Mm-hmm. I feel for restaurants now and for chefs when you're assaulted with so many patrons who come in and say, I can't have this or that or that. I had a really... a funny example of someone who handled it because she found out literally she couldn't eat anything. She'd been hospitalized. And so the list was literally peanut, shellfish, dairy, gluten. And so she made a business card with everything she couldn't have. And on the back it says, I'm so sorry. It sucks for me too.
That
was so cute.
That's nice.
I was like, you hand that to the chef and the chef laughs at least when as they go to try to make her like a few green beans. I mean, what are you going to do?
That's very nice.
But I thought it was sweet.
I was going to say, don't go out. Don't go to a restaurant. But if you have that card, that would be, that's
cute.
Yeah,
right. It was very cute. Yeah. And she said, I still want to go out and see friends. So it's like, I warn them. And if they can help me, great. And if not, oh well. Right. We'll figure it out. Last question from the audience, unless anybody's still passing some around. Did you obtain any guidance from etiquette experts when writing your book? Or are you the expert?
Oh, from my grandparents, I guess. You know, those experts, my parents.
Mm-hmm.
The great maitre d's and restaurants staff and the luxury liner staff who adopted me when we were traveling.
Oh, my gosh, amazing.
Those were the experts.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like you had an incredible life. You traveled like crazy growing up.
Yes, yeah.
So exposed to so many different cultures and etiquette from all over the world.
Right.
So was it easy for you to write this book in some ways once you started?
Actually, it was, I didn't know how to write this book, you know. So he said, well, we want 20 to 25,000 words. I said, wow. I'll tell you what, I'll give you 50 and you cut 25, you know, which he did.
That's great.
And so as soon as he did that, I got the point. Then I understood what it was. Mm-hmm. Because I got so carried away by the word manners rather than table manners that we cut out an enormous amount of material, which will then become book two.
Mm-hmm. That's great, though.
Or three.
It's clever. Overwrite. And now you've got another book coming. Well, there are a couple other questions that I have for you, too, just about food in general and your love of food. And what do you love in the food scene today? It's changed a lot, I feel like, since you cooked at Stars. And
right.
Become, I don't know, we get so focused on all of these nuances of these things, gluten-free, dairy-free, but what do you love that's happening?
I love restaurants in Paris like La Maison, where, you know, there was foie gras on the menu. So I thought, I hadn't had foie gras. I'm living in Mexico. I hadn't had foie gras in a long time. And out came this casserole, little copper casserole about this big.
Beautiful.
And inside was a whole lobe of foie gras, covered with a Madeira sauce and black truffles. And I thought, right, that's food.
I'll have that, please.
I'll have that.
Twice.
So I like that boldness and that clarity and everything. Mm-hmm. I don't like what's happening is that, you know, you see the same plate of food in Hong Kong, Sydney, San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, you know, with all the little dots.
Mm-hmm.
And that schmear, which is like someone took a cat and dipped in sauce and dragged its ass across the plate. No. Forget all that.
So clearly you're always studying and you're looking
Absolutely.
At trends because
Absolutely.
You're right. It's almost too precious food like that
right.
to enjoy
right.
and relax into. So
right.
do you see any trends right now that you like in cooking?
Certainly the focus on perfect ingredients mm-hmm. is the one. It's the guideline for everybody all the time, always has been.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the way forward.
Mm-hmm.
A great chef is somebody who steps back and says, here are the beautiful ingredients. The fact that you've found them, bought them, prepared them mm-hmm. perfectly is enough. You don't have to see anything more.
Right.
You don't have to, you know, surround it by reduced balsamic vinegar dots. And you don't have to, you know, say, oh, look at me, look at me. No, look at the asparagus.
Right, look it up. Amazing. I got one more question for you from the audience. Do you cook Mexican food, and what are your favorite regions of Mexico? It's a big question. It's a big country.
I don't cook. I mean, I started to cook with all the fabulous ingredients in mm-hmm. Yucatan. There's one called chilmole, which is a paste. They have three basic pastes in Yucatan. One is the red one from achiote, annatto. Then the one green one from pumpkin seeds, and the black one, chilmole, which is from basically incinerated chilies.
Mm-hmm.
They roast them in a big pan, like a what am I trying to say?
A dry
paella pan.
Oh, okay.
Over a fire, and they turn to charcoal. I mean, they're charcoal throughout. Then they put them in water, they grind them up, mix them with oregano, and anyway, it's called chilmole. So one of the great dishes in Yucatan is reino negro, which is turkey, God help us. But anyway, you know, if you have to eat turkey, it might as well be in Reino Negro. Poached in this, and it makes this rich stock, and then they enrich it with this black paste, and then they have a big ball of very spicy ground pork meat, which then is also cooked in that. It's fantastic.
Sounds amazing.
So I couldn't wait. I was doing all these things with the chilmole, and I had, you know, one dish. I invited some Mexican friends, Yucatecan friends over, and I put on a big white plate, you know, a little thin bed of this chilmole, which I had cooked, and then I put avocado and sliced and pressed out, and I had a little fresh crab meat and some, you know, radish salsa and everything. And they said, this is not Yucatecan food. And I said, well, it should be.
Developing a new region of Mexico.
But now I just let them cook, you know. I mean, I'm not going to cook a whole pork leg in the ground.
It's a lot of work.
So I just go every morning and eat their version of it.
You know? So that was my next question for you. How do you eat living in Mexico? And are you cooking for yourself?
Yes, for sure. But I mean, mainly, you know, in Mexico, it's important to say Yucatan because it's very different from all. I don't know the rest of Mexico. I only know the Yucatan.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's pork, chicken, and fish. All the best fish goes to Mexico City or the United States or Japan or China. So the retail fish is not great. Unless I go to the beach, then every morning, you know, I go down to the beach and wave money. And the fishermen come up and they bring me a basket of lobsters or stone crab claws this big, which cost 20 cents. And that's all wonderful. But the rest of the time, it's chicken and pork, and they do a much better job than I do.
Unbelievable.
So that's every morning in the tacos.
Oh, my gosh, it sounds incredible. Is that your favorite part about living there, the food?
Yes. That's why I stopped there. I mean, I was stuck there because of hurricanes, but when I tasted the Reino Negro, I thought, this is a world-class dish. The other one is called papadzules, which is with a sauce made from pumpkin seed, which nobody in the Yucatan makes anymore because all the grandmas are dead. nobody, because it's too much work. There's a final step in it which makes it from delicious to world-class, which nobody does anymore. But I was trained by some Yucatecan grandmas in the jungle showing me how to do it.
Wow.
When they were showing me this black paste. And I thought, yeah. So that is a world-class sauce. It has to be made by somebody standing there at the table. Mm-hmm. You're seated, you're ready to eat. They make the sauce and give it to you because it has a shelf life of, you know, 15 seconds.
Incredible. Incredible. So
that's why I stayed, because of those two dishes.
That's why you stayed. I'm looking. I could ask him questions about food in Mexico. I'm dying to know where you'd live next, but I think that would probably give away your restaurant idea, right?
Kerala. That's my next one. 6 months in Kerala.
Wow. So we have just a couple of minutes left. And
because I think Yucatecan food and Indian food need to be put together.
Really?
Well, mole and curry. I mean, you know, as loose a thing as the term curry means
everything.
Know, everything.
Yeah.
Mole means everything. But actually, there's sort of all those spices ground up together.
Put together. Incredible. I love that your mind is still thinking about the next idea.
Right. That's what I want to do.
I think so. Restaurant, I can hear, besides this book, I can hear another cookbook brewing.
Absolutely.
Potentially.
That's my next cookbook.
It's thrilling. That's so exciting. So I hate that our time is coming to a close, but I think if I were going to ask you one last question, which I can't believe it's been 65 minutes, what would you want people to take away from your book? What's the most important message you have for people? I love the whole chapter on pretentiousness as well.
Oh, that was my favorite. You know, that was my favorite chapter to write, publicly, because I said pretentious, you know, people, my big wine glass, big wine glass. It's only pretentious if you pour, you know, cheap Chilean Sauvignon Blanc in it. If you put Montrachet in it, it's not pretentious. It needs that glass, you know, huge napkins. Oh, that's pretentious. No. I'm wearing Armani. I want, you know, the napkin go from here down to there, you know. And finger bowls, you know, it's sort of so pretentious. They're so useful.
Mm-hmm.
If you're eating shrimp, I mean, in the Philippines, they deal with shrimp with a knife and fork, and I tried that. I mean, that's just way too much work. So you have to use your fingers. But if you've got all that sauce and butter or oil, whatever, all of you, you know, and you use a napkin, then you need another napkin right away. But a finger bowl, like that, you're done.
Kind of brilliant.
It's perfect. It's perfect. So let me just...
You can see my favorite parts.
Yes. Conclusion. The most important thing to know about manners is they're not about you. The more you think about those around you and the less you think about yourself, the more likely you are to behave well. And the better you behave, the more likely you are to be invited back.
I love it. It's a beautiful note to end on.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. So I just want to thank the incomparable Chef Jeremiah Tower for being here this evening with us and for talking about his new book. And I'm Amanda Haas, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is officially adjourned.
Wow. Done.
Done.